You're listening to the Food Files podcast. The latest from the Oklahoma State University Robert M. Kerr Food and Agricultural Product Center. Here's your host, Darren Scott.
Welcome to the Food Files, a series of podcasts from Oklahoma State University's Robert M. Kerr Food and Agricultural Product Center. I'm your host, Darren Scott, FAPC food scientist, and today we're going to talk about kitchen appliances and the risks associated with them if you don't use them properly. To help discuss this topic with me today is William McGlynn, FAPC food scientist. Good morning, William.
Good morning, Darren.
I guess I should kind of focus in on the types of kitchen appliances that we'll talk about today. These probably wouldn't be considered to be your sort of not necessarily run-of-the-mill appliances like thermometers or measuring cups, spoons, that sort of thing.
Knives are pretty dangerous.
Depending. Don't run with them. But, you know, they fall into that category of prosumer, sort of a little bit above your average consumer level of usage, but maybe a little less or a little below what you might consider to be a professional use of the appliance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just kind of curious, what do you think, before we kind of get into the particular examples that we're going to talk about, you know, what do you think, if you have any thoughts on what might be the reason why we've seen kind of an increase in the interest or at least the use of these kinds of appliances? Because I have a couple of ideas, but I want to pick your brain first because I'm not a copycat.
I think there are probably a lot of reasons for it. People are interested in convenience. People don't have the same time to cook that they used to. And so a lot of these things are designed to make the whole cooking process easier. But also, you know, there's been a rebirth of interest in kind of artisanal cooking. And so you're seeing a lot of unusual things. And that's part of the attraction, I think, the ability to be able to do something that people hadn't been able to do before.
You know, I think that's right. And, you know, one of the things that I've thought about is also the use of, or maybe the shrinking and the use of computers. So, you know, a lot of these particular appliances are computer controlled. And so that takes a lot of the guesswork out and maybe some of the scariness out of some of the examples we'll talk about here in a second. And, you know, I do think that that has helped kind of push that along a little bit.
I think that's right.
You know, you don't have to worry about, I need to babysit this thing for the entire, you know, cook time. I can't walk away and do something else, or at least not for very long. I can't forget about it, set it and forget it, which is kind of the advantage of some of these kinds of appliances is that, you know, you don't have to put in the amount of time that you would have had to do in the past. And I certainly agree with your statement about, you know, this interest in cooking, being able to do things maybe differently. Artisanal, foodie-type culture has kind of increased the interest in being able to cook in different ways. And I actually think that's a good thing. You know, I want to make sure I kind of stress that because, you know, when I was growing up, I can remember not that the things were plain, but you had maybe a limited number of options, you know, of different kinds of things that you might find in the grocery store or things that you might have, you know, at home to eat.
Yeah, that's right. Not only the cooking equipment, but the number of ingredients that you could have or the seasonality of those ingredients.
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah, there are a lot more options than there used to be. And I think you're right. I think the fact that these are smart machines in a way that wasn't possible before opens up different types of cooking that you simply couldn't have done in the past or not done very easily. So, yeah, that's a big part of it.
Well, let's kind of segue into our first example here, the sort of low pressure cookers, sort of the Instapot type cookers. You know, those are kind of really, really popular now, taking off. I will format this three questions for three different appliances. First question, do you own one?
I do.
All right.
Yeah, I've owned one, I guess, for about 3 years now.
Okay. How often do you use it? The next one, is it sitting up in the closet somewhere or?
No. I use it. I probably use it two or three times a month.
Okay. All right. I have to admit, I own one myself. It does sit in the closet for a little bit longer than probably I had originally intended. But I have an excuse. The apartment gets hot. So, you know, I typically use it in the wintertime when it's a little bit cooler outside, therefore cooler inside.
Yeah, well, it's kind of well-suited to winter-type foods, too. That's fair.
All right, the biggie. So what do you think is the associated risk with those pressure cookers?
Yeah, well, as you say, they're fairly low pressure compared to a traditional pressure cooker. Mm. And I would say that's probably the biggest risk factor. If you use it the way it's intended to be used, if you follow the instructions, it's quite safe. I don't have any concerns about that.
Right.
But I guess the biggest risk that I would see is if someone doesn't follow the directions and...
Yes.
You know, we mentioned there's an interest in more artisanal type food processing.
Yes.
One of those would be home canning, right?
Yes, yes.
And so, you know, it says all over there, don't use this as a pressure cooker. Don't try and can green beans, corn, these sort of low acid food products because it doesn't get hot enough.
That's right.
And so if someone just, you know, figures, okay, it's a pressure cooker, I can use it to cook that sort of thing. I'm going to follow this old recipe that I have. It says to pressure cook it for 20 minutes.
Yes.
I put it in for 20 minutes. Well, your Instant Pot, not to single out any brands, doesn't get as hot as a traditional pressure cooker, so it's going to be undercooked.
Yes.
And so you're running the risk of botulism with something like that.
Yep.
So, again, you would have to be... You would have to not follow the directions.
Right. That's...
You would have to ignore the cautions and the warnings, but, you know, I can see someone doing that, and that would certainly be a risk.
Yeah, you know, and that's exactly right. You know, I don't know that people necessarily understand that, they, you know, it doesn't reach quite the same pressure or the same temperature. And, you know, if you just cook and immediately eat, you're fine. The issue becomes if you try to, as you said, you know, you're actually trying to can something that you can put out, store at room temperature for some length of time.
Right.
And so, you know, what is it, roughly 12, 24 hours, you know, if you've actually tried to can something like a vegetable, is where you're going to start to have the potential for botulism to kind of pop its ugly head up.
Right. Yeah. So I think that'd be the biggest risk for that piece of kitchen hardware.
Again, it's goes hand in hand with that interest in doing things differently. You also see this sort of, hacking mentality that is, you know, using pieces of equipment maybe in ways that they weren't originally intended, you know, and that's what I'm always concerned about because, you know, you can say, well, I can cook this kind of product in my rice cooker or I can, you know, do this with that. And so, you know, that's kind of goes into, you know, what you said is it's follow the instructions, you're going to be perfectly fine. But, you know, if you want to be creative, you probably should still try to be creative within the instructions provided with a piece of equipment.
Yeah, when in doubt, get some advice.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, call somebody.
Like Darren Scott.
Or William McGlynn. Second appliance that we'll talk about today, kind of segueing in, the sous vide immersion circulator or oven.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Water oven, sure.
Do you own one?
I do.
Uh-huh. How often do you use it?
I'll be honest. I use that one a little less often. I probably use it about once a month, once every other month, something like that.
Okay. All right. Might want to maybe just give a brief kind of description just in case people might not be familiar.
Yeah. Well, sous vide, it's a technique that was – it's been around for 20-plus years now. It's very commonly used in the food service industry. So basically, you're taking whatever the food item is, you're typically vacuum sealing it in a plastic bag, and then you're immersing it in this water bath, this temperature-controlled water bath, so it'll cook over a period of 6, 8, 10, 12 hours,
okay,
maybe even longer, at a relatively low temperature, so 150, 160 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. So it's
okay,
a very long, slow, wet cooking process.
Okay. All right. Have to admit, I have one as well, and just like the first one, my apartment gets hot, so I have an excuse for not using it very often. Again, usually during the wintertime. So what's the associated risk with sous vide?
Yeah, well, anytime you start vacuum sealing, and I think this will lead into a subsequent discussion.
Yes.
You know, we mentioned botulism before. Botulism, it's caused by a bacteria, Clostridium botulinum, that can only grow in an environment with no oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you doing when you vacuum seal a food? You're removing all the oxygen. That has some great advantages in extending the shelf life, but it opens up the risk for these toxin-producing bacteria to grow.
Sure.
So that's the risk. And in the sous vide process, again, as long as you follow the instructions, follow the recipes that are out there, it's safe. The main thing there, the main concern I would have would be too low a temperature, too low a cooking temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So if you start to get down below about 140 degrees Fahrenheit, you're getting into that range where it may not be hot enough to suppress the growth of some of those bacteria.
So you basically have an incubator oven.
So yeah, you could basically just be incubating that as you think that you're cooking it. And all the recipes I've seen, they really don't go below that.
Right.
So maybe a little lower, 135, something like that.
I think I've seen that, yes.
But that's kind of the bottom end. So you definitely don't want to go any lower than that.
Yeah.
Higher temperatures, not a concern, not a worry. You can cook it for an extended period of time at those temperatures, and it'll be fine. It may fall apart, but from a food safety standpoint, it'll be fine.
Sure.
But at those lower temperatures, you're running a risk there. So again, you want to follow the instructions.
Right. Because I was going to say, I think at those lower temperatures, you typically don't see that as extended a period
true.
Of time.
True, true, true.
I think, you know, if you're seeing like 135, it may be for just like maybe 2 hours or something
right.
like that.
Right. And there's definitely a time consideration there.
Yes. Same thing. You know, my concern would be people trying to be creative with those things, because that was one of the reasons that it took me a very long time to buy one for myself, was because it was that concern is, okay, now what do I need to do here to make sure that I don't accidentally make myself sick? You know, where am I going to find these recipes that I can actually trust? You know,
I'm sure it had nothing to do with the cost. I'm sure. Strictly the food safety concern.
I'm not cheap. I'm a spendthrift. Two different things.
I never said otherwise.
But, you know, it's sort of like, and I'll kind of go back a little bit with pressure cookers. You know, a lot of those original recipes were actually developed by USDA.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you had some trustworthy sort of government agency that had put those together, that had put time and effort into making sure that there was a lot of sort of wiggle room in those recipes to make
right.
sure that they were safe.
Yes. A safety factor.
Yes. 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 And so, you know, for some of the recipes that you find, you know, I'm always concerned that people will just look on the internet and maybe those recipes are good, but they might not be good. You know, and there's not really an easy way to know
right.
unless, you know, you have some experience. To be able to look at a recipe and say, well, wait a minute, this doesn't quite add up. These numbers look like they might make this this process a little unsafe.
Are you suggesting we can't trust everything we read on the internet?
Oh, never.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. You want to know where the recipe comes from. You want to know how it was developed. At least you want to have some reason to consider it trustworthy.
Hmm. Last appliance, and it kind of, we'll say that it is I'm guessing that the risk will be similar to the first two, and that would be vacuum sealers.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite as, high tech in a way, but certainly, you know, you wouldn't have seen these available at the consumer level just because, you know, used to take such a large amount, or the vacuum pump was relatively large, you know, to be able to pull a vacuum in a container. And so, you know, this ability to shrink that down to both make it convenient and to reduce cost has sort of increased the use of vacuum sealers. So do you own one?
I do.
How often do you use it?
I use that one fairly often. Once a week, twice a week. Just depends on what I'm trying to package.
Okay.
But yeah, I use it fairly often.
You and my dad.
Mm-hmm.
What can't you vacuum seal?
It doesn't work great on soup, I will say that.
Or donuts.
Well, I haven't tried that.
He found out the hard way.
I can see that.
So, what's the risk?
Same idea. You're removing the oxygen from the packaging. And so, again, you're creating an environment where those toxin-producing bacteria can grow. Clostridium botulinum, Clostridium perfringens is a closely related type. They can both make you very, very sick.
I'll have to admit, I own one as well. And since this one doesn't really generate a lot of heat, I use it quite often. Same thing.
It does a great job at extending the shelf life.
That's, yes, it does. Mm-hmm. You know, preventing freezer burn
right.
on cuts of meat, especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's very, very handy. And as you said, you know, you really have to be careful and understand, you know, these things are items that I can vacuum seal and not have an issue. These are items, you know, I really need to be aware of. And so, you know, raw meat, again, is going to be relatively, I don't want to say easy, but the risk is different.
Right. Much lower risk.
Yes, as opposed to cooked meat.
Right.
And, you know, you want to make sure that if you're going to vacuum seal a a cooked meat product, that that product is below or what, 40, 45 degrees, or at least outside or below the danger zone or not within the danger zone for 2 hours?
Yeah, well, yes, you're relying on temperature to control the growth of those bacteria, potential growth. And you're right. Cooked foods in general are higher risk than raw foods. And that's for a couple of reasons. One thing, those bacteria, they exist in what's called a spore form. That's very difficult to destroy. But if it's heated, that actually stimulates it to grow. And so you're kind of giving a jump start to those spores when you cook the food typically. And the other reason is you're killing off all the other bacteria that might be present. So these bacteria don't necessarily compete well with others.
Right.
So you've created a wonderful environment for them to do very well. So yeah, cooked food is a higher risk. You're really relying on temperature to control the potential growth of those bacteria. So yeah, you want to refrigerate it and keep it refrigerated during storage or frozen.
Or frozen, right.
As soon as possible after vacuum packing it. Yep, that's going to be your safety factor there.
Right. And that's definitely a discussion that I've had with my dad. It's like, all right, if you're going to do these things, make sure that you're either, you know, let's refrigerate them first, vacuum seal, and then take them back to the refrigerator or the freezer. I'll save that for the next podcast when I bring you back. What do you see as potential...
Quivering with anticipation.
As you should be. What do you see as potential... What other sorts of these prosumer type appliances on the horizons, or do you see any?
Oh, I'm sure there will be. It's kind of hard to predict. But I do think we'll see more. I think, you know, you've referred to the miniaturization of electronics and these devices getting smarter. I think that'll drive things. It wouldn't surprise me at all to see something like one of the low pressure cookers that you talked about just getting smarter and smarter and being able to do more types of products, maybe different types of cook processes.
Okay.
You know, the other thing that's become popular here lately are those air fryers.
Yes. I think one.
So do I. I think they'll become smarter. And, you know, it's conceivable you could even see some combination devices that could do different types of cooking.
Well, you know, I actually saw one. I can't remember what the name of it was, but it basically would air fry. I think it would do some pressure cooking, act as a slow cooker as well. And so you're starting to see these things kind of pop up. You know, one that is near and dear to my heart because, you know, we've known each other for a little bit. We were talking about this back in the day, as the kids used to say. Halogen ovens, you know. I almost got one of those back in the 90s. And those are still around, but they haven't quite taken off like, you know, I thought that they might. You know, halogen ovens use a halogen lamp as a heat source. Supposedly, they're supposed to be much more energy efficient and they're supposed to cook much faster. I think one of the disadvantages was the food typically had to be very sort of thin. And that might be one of the reasons why it hasn't taken off. But I wouldn't be surprised, as you know, we've just talked about miniaturization, computerization, that that might potentially help something like a halogen type oven sort of take off.
Yeah, that's possible. You know, you've got, what are those heating surfaces? I can't think of the induction.
Okay,
induction
yeah.
Surfaces. I think those may become much more popular as well.
You might give a short description of, you know, when you talk about induction.
Yeah, well, basically you're inducing a current in the metal material of the cooking vessel. So you don't have an actual heat source. You're actually heating the metal vessel that the food is in by magnetic fields.
Right, right. And so,
so you're heating that directly. So you don't have a hot cook surface. You don't have to worry about heating that up. So it's a lot more efficient. It heats more directly. There are some advantages to it. But of course, it only works with certain types of cook vessels.
Right.
Pots and pans. Got to be metal. Got to be the right kind of metal.
Well, you know, I think that probably wraps up what I intended to kind of cover with this podcast today. So thanks for coming out, William.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Food Files. We would like to thank SunUp TV for the production of this podcast. For additional food industry information, please make sure to visit our website at www.fapc.biz. Until next time.